Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. In this episode of the podcast, we bring you a recording of a panel session organised by the Development Policy Centre at the recent Asia Pacific Policy Society Conference at the Crawford School of Public Policy. Chaired by Stephen Howes, the panel discusses the issues of infrastructure maintenance, utilities regulation, and energy subsidies.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning and welcome back to the APPS conference. My name's Stephen Howes and I'm the Director of the Development Policy Centre here at the Crawford School. So I was asked to put together a session on development policy, and I want to thank Quentin for the invitation to do that. And in putting together this session, I guess I really had two objectives in mind, being that development policy is obviously a very broad-ranging, wide-ranging theme. So I wanted to focus in, and I thought focusing on infrastructure, or really infrastructure and energy, would be a good idea. Infrastructure has long been a priority of the G20, and as Daniel highlighted in his presentation, it's been sort of promoted by Australia to be particularly prominent for this G20. After all, the Prime Minister is our Prime Minister for Infrastructure. Infrastructure is often presented as a financing issue, and Daniel gave one of those figures, $50 trillion needed, and I hope by the end of this session you'll see that it's much more than financing that's required to get infrastructure to work. Then energy is obviously closely related to infrastructure, if you just think about the power sector, but energy has also been a G20 priority, and I think it was in 2010 the G20 made a commitment to eliminate energy subsidies. And that's going to be the focus of our presentation on energy. So that was in terms of the theme. And then the other thought I had in mind was, as Tom mentioned, we want to also give coverage of the Pacific. And since our centre works a lot on the Pacific, I thought we'd try to achieve, get some Pacific content and flavour into this session. So anyway, I'm very happy with the panel we've been able to bring together for you. And I'll just introduce them briefly in turn so that I don't have to interrupt later on. Our first speaker is James Ryan, and James is the Chief Economist of the Vanuatu Utilities Regulatory Authority. He hails from the UK, where he has a background in regulatory issues and management consulting. And his topic is the political economy of utility regulation, the case of Vanuatu. Then we have Dr. Shika Jha. Shika was an academic in India, following a stellar career there, joined the Asian Development Bank, where she's now principal economist in the research department, and she's currently working on a project that she's going to be talking to us about on energy subsidies and reform in Asia. And then our final speaker is Sanjeevi Rajasingham, and Sanjeevi had a long career in the World Bank, where, among other things, he was responsible for the entire World Bank's portfolio of infrastructure investments in Africa. And he now heads up PRIF, which is the Pacific Regional Infrastructure Facility, which is a multi-donor initiative. And so we're fortunate we're going to be able to provide you with stories, evidence, not only from the Pacific, but also from Africa. And Sanjeevi's title is Road Infrastructure Maintenance, Lessons from Africa and the Pacific. And I guess often in infrastructure, we forget all about maintenance and think only about new assets, and I think that'll be a very important corrective. So we've got three quite different, but I think all very interesting presentations around this theme of infrastructure and energy reform. And we'll have the three speakers one by one. And unless you've got a burning question, clarification, we'll hold off the Q&A until the end. And I'll just remind all the speakers that they need to stick to their 20-minute time limit to allow enough time for questions and answers. All right, well, without further ado, could I ask you to welcome our first speaker, James Ryan.
Thank you, Stephen. My name is James Ryan. I think, judging from your introduction, I am the Pacific flavour of this section, so I apologise that your Pacific flavour has got an English accent. But I've been involved with the URA since 2009 in Vanuatu, where I first went out there just after the office had been opened and performed the first energy tariff review that had ever been carried out in Vanuatu. For my first stint, and then I returned in August 2012, where I've been there since, working and helping them through a number of issues, some of which I'm going to talk you through this morning. So what am I going to talk about? The title of the speech is Political Economy of Utility Regulation. Political economy is one of those phrases that means lots of different things, often unrelated to each other, to different people. So what I'm going to talk about here is how does the economic, political and social fabric of the nation in which the regulator exists, how does that impact the successful establishment of that independent regulator? I'm not going to talk in detail about why we need independent regulation, although I mention it, but I think in the context of infrastructure development and the private sector's involvement in infrastructure development, more and more there is a call for independent regulation of utility services especially. Anyway, based on that examination, we'll then draw some conclusions on how to successfully establish independent institutions in small contexts like Vanuatu, and how external aid can be most effectively utilised to support those institutions. So I'm going to go through a bit of background, tell you the story of the URA, review some specific challenges that we've recently faced that have challenged the existence of the institution, actually. Some reflections on what it's like to try and achieve these results in a place like Vanuatu, and then draw conclusions on how institutions like the URA can be established and how external aid plays a role in that development. So, just a quick context. Vanuatu is in the southwestern Pacific between New Caledonia, Solomon Islands, and Fiji. You've already had a map of the Pacific, but that's where we are. We have a population of 250,000 people, which is large for Pacific standards. The urban population is roughly 50,000, and those are the ones who mostly have access to mains power, electricity, and grid-based water services. The vast bulk of the population still exists and is a rural population based on subsistence agriculture. There is a small amount of exports. Per capita, it's 164th in the world, so we are a small developing country. But in Pacific contexts, bigger than some very small places. Politically, having gained independence in 1980, we have a parliamentary democracy. There have been very interesting tides in history of independent Vanuatu, resulting in what we have today is a very, very fragmented political system. There's no differentiation on policy between the political parties, and there's a fairly rapid turnaround and merry-go-round of the politicians forming coalitions and alliances and then undermining the other side, resulting again a lot of motions of no confidence and reshuffles. So while there is but the good news is while there is instability of personnel on the government side, the institutions of the judiciary and democracy are not challenged. So we have elections, the courts are respected, court decisions are waited for, rather than coups and revolutions and other things that are unstable. So we have a stable structure, but unstable system within that structure, which has implications on how we have to operate. I spent half my time briefing new ministers. For electricity, we're unusual in the Pacific. I'm going through fast because I want to get through all the background so you know the context so I can tell the story. We are unusual that we have private electricity company since the 1930s. For relatively small on a global scale, very small on a global scale, electricity networks. Very diesel-dominated generation mix like most places in the Pacific. Overall, the service reliability is very good for the Pacific. Prices are high, and one of our main issues is that most people don't have access to mains electricity at all. The grids are focused in urban areas. On the water side, it's a mixed story. Good quality supply in Port Vila. Drinking water is very good and very reliable. That's supplied by a private company. Other urban areas are supplied by the government where there is a lack of investment in infrastructure. Quality is much more variable and is a poor service. And there are some smaller grids around the place. A lot of the infrastructure in some of the areas was put in World War II and hasn't changed since. In that context, the URA was established in 2008 after legislation was passed in 2007. So in our role is to balance the interests of consumers, the private sector utilities, and the government to ensure the provision of safe, reliable, and affordable electricity and water services to maximise and to increase access to those services and to promote the long-term interests of the customers. In order to do that, we have the power to set maximum prices, subject to some constraints, which I won't go into here, and we can set and monitor safety and reliability standards. And we also play a very important advisory role to the government on electricity and water services, and why that's important I'll come to in a minute. So just briefly, the case for independent regulation in Vanuatu, because it's not a common model in the Pacific. We have both private and government-funded and government-provided services. Historically, the results of that have been the private services are pretty good quality, but high prices. The government-provided services suffer from underinvestment and are pretty low quality. In both of those cases, the long-term interests of customers and consumers are not best served, either because they're paying too much for it, or they're not getting a good service and there isn't investment for the long term. What we can do, one of the side effects of having an independent regulator, is it provides a focal point for resource and expertise for people like, I'm an externally funded expert, I'm not from Vanuatu, as you may have guessed, but I'm there and I can help with any issues that any party in the industry has, and we can help solve it. And I work for a body that is that's aim is to protect consumers. So I am not subject to changing political winds, or I'm not subject to a profit gain, because the utility companies get in their own experts as well. So what we provide is a little focal point for expertise to be dropped in into that can actually try and deliver a long-term benefit to customers. And in that sense, having a multi-sector scope, because again, multi-sector regulators isn't a usual circumstance, that gives us a bit of scale benefit, so I can work and the team can work across different sectors. And that scope is looking to be increased. There's talk about increasing our scope to cover LPG, fuel, ports, and other monopolies that exist. So this is deliberately a long and complicated list, so apologies if I rattle through them fast, but I'm trying to make a point. We have to design feed-in tariffs for solar. This is my to-do list now. I've got to design feed-in tariff scheme for solar home systems. I've got to advise on both parties on PPA negotiations. We've got to work on a World Bank scheme for connection subsidies. The company, you know, because the electricity company need a bridge repaired, the Public Works Department doesn't even respond. The Municipal Council don't pay their bills for street lighting, and UNELCO wants to increase customer tariffs to cover those costs. The Public Works Department wants to outsource management of the water services, but the Ministry of Finance wants to have the revenue from the water service to pay for other things. UNELCO wants to install prepayment meters, but they've never had to build a business case before because they've always just increased prices. A local solar panel company puts out ads saying Vanuatu has the second highest electricity prices in the world. Ouch! And that looks good for us, and so we have to deal with that. The Public Works Department can't fix the leaks because their electricity bill is so high, but the budget hasn't been allocated for water services at all, and the Minister of Finance won't give any more. So, first conclusion. Small doesn't mean simple, right? This is very important for everybody to understand. We have all of the same issues that exist in a large market. I deal with all exactly the same stuff that the energy regulator here deals with, and I have to deal with all the stuff that a small company has to deal with. I mean the team. Difference isn't that great sometimes. We have a fraction of the resource. There are 6 people on our team, including external experts and including the cleaner. Any resource that does exist, therefore, instantly gets pulled in all directions, and the to-do list instantly becomes very long, because you drop an agency into all of these issues that are already live, and everyone suddenly says, well, what about this, and what about this, and what about this, and what about this? And so you have to prioritize, because otherwise you get swamped, and you don't deliver results, and you don't create a good name for the organization. If you get a name that you just would a waste of time, and you only ever absorb information and don't give anything back that adds value, bad things can start to happen, which started to happen in 2012. So in the years running up to 2012, a series of lots of events strained the relationship that the URA had with, initially, our primary stakeholder, if you like, which is the private electricity company, over a number of different issues in a number of years. Gradually got more strained. That then also spilled over into straining relationships with the government, to the extent that in early 2012, we couldn't even get meetings with anybody that we needed to regulate, utility or government. That culminated in them, the government informing the CEO at the time that they weren't going to extend his contract after the beginning of October. The beginning of September 2012. And because it came as a surprise, that shouldn't have been much of a surprise with hindsight, that position, and they hadn't advertised, and the advertisement's got to go through all these processes, that stayed at vacant for more than a year. So we were more than a year without a CEO. So what happened? And in the middle of all that, we heard rumours of an attempt to amend our acts to water down our powers, and that became real in September 2012. And what we found happened, a small group of ministers, officials, private sector, drafted an amendment to our core legislation. We weren't informed, and we deliberately cut out the process. It included constraints on our power, obstacles to us doing things, weakening anti-competitive protection in the marketplace, and guaranteeing, because one of the parties was a new geothermal plant company, guaranteeing that any price that they charge the utility would get passed on to consumers regardless of what that price is, which obviously the economists in the audience know what that's going to do. That was presented, despite the relevant minister's protestations to the contrary, by surprise to Parliament in September 2012, just after the URA CEO's contract had finished and he'd gone. So that was potentially the death knell was ringing for the URA at that point. But we had a lucky escape. Because it was basically purely procedural. The bill hadn't gone through the normal process to be put before Parliament. There was an election the next month, so the opposition MPs took the opportunity to make the government look bad and walked out and froze Parliament. So it had nothing to do with the content of the bill or people liking us or not liking us. It's just because the process wasn't going followed and the elections were the next month. Then they had an election, and then after an election, there's lots of wrangling about who's going to form a government. A government was formed, then it became unstable as a vote of no confidence 4 months later. All of that political wrangling and instability gave us an opportunity to get hold of the draft amendment that we finally got in January, which is another 3 months after it got presented to Parliament, work through it and say, okay, you want to amend our act. Rather, we didn't say no, we said yes, okay, amend it, but we went through it line by line and changed the amendment so that it didn't do any of the things that certain parties wanted it to do and actually reinforced our power. So we kind of swiped that one out of it while everyone else is distracted arguing with each other. Comes to my first kind of reflection. There's a J-curve of how people are going to accept an independent institution where there's you're dropping it into a context where there's vested interests. First of all, your novel. That sounds like a good idea. We'll have a meeting with them. Nothing's really changed in the status quo, and people don't understand your powers and have no respect for them. But then you start trying to do things and trying to change things, and it's, to some extent, a zero-sum game where you have a strong vested interest and someone will lose. And those people, or those parties, will fight to keep the status quo. And while the institution is young, it is easier to attack the institution itself rather than try and change its decisions. So it's easier to stop the game than play the game. And then if you survive that, which is not necessarily the case, if you can start to win little victories and show value. So I'm going to talk in a minute about how we survive this, but you've got to show value of the institution and deliver results, the benefit that you can have a clear benefit for people. Then eventually you can drive a vision for the marketplace. So an interesting discussion this morning was about which is, in my context, I've got to think about what does electricity look like in Vanuatu in 30 years' time? And it's not going to be mains electricity in every single island, because you've got 65 islands, some of which you've got 100 people on. What does the end result look like? How do we design a market to deliver that? That's the kind of conversation that we want to be having, but we can't have yet because we haven't got through this process yet. So how do you survive this? Strictly maintain independence. Don't get drawn into any of this infighting. Be obviously open to suggestion, consultative and transparent. But be pragmatic. Make sure you can deliver results that people appreciate. Don't get drawn into legal battles over matters of principle that aren't going to have an impact on anybody, because the institution is at risk. And in order to do that, you've got to demonstrate being flexible and sensible. But below the surface, you have to understand the networks of influence, because they are working behind the scenes. And one key thing that the URA didn't do in 2010 to 12 was ensure that doors remained open. The relationships were lost. And partly in order to do that, you've got to do the legwork, because even if it's not intentional, sometimes things don't happen just because people don't understand the importance of it or are uncomfortable doing it. But if you can help somebody by drafting the letter that they need to send, taking it to them to sign it, hand-delivering it to the person that needs to receive it, watching them opening it, drafting the response, things start to happen. You can you're not forcing people's hand, but you're just demonstrating to them how they can get what they want. Otherwise, they just don't know. And involve the public. One thing that we make sure we do all the time is get out to communities, listen to people, because people don't, consumers don't shout in Vanuatu. It's not a very complaining culture. Normally the utilities and the government get away with lots of things. Get your own data, because it gives you credibility, and it gives you a story you can tell and earns your respect. You can showcase good results, and you can absorb criticism for people who have done bad things. And that's a service we can provide to utilities. Say, well, look, this has happened. It's not all their fault. Partly it's because you don't pay your bills, you know. So we can absorb some criticism, and that shows the value of the institution. Okay, blimey, I've got to be fast. Okay, so small, next one. Small does mean close. Everyone knows everyone. Influence is an easy commodity, and where you don't have a strong institution, it's very hard for someone to resist the powers of that influence. So I'll skip through, because I want to get to a point in the end. That means external support is very useful in the early stages of an institution. I agree when, Colin, you said that Vanuatu does have potential to have an independent regulator. I think we do. There is capacity. There is a capacity pool that can provide that. But it's very hard to do that from initially, from the ground up. So how do you build something like the URA and give it the best chance of success? At the beginning, at the early stages of the establishment of an institution, incumbent interests are very strong. The independence of the institution relies on the individual who's actually doing the job. And if that person's within the system, it can be very hard. So it's a good idea to bring someone from overseas, literally overseas, to do that job. Then you can get into a transitionary phase where the focus is on building the capacity of the team and putting in place robust processes. Once you have the precedent of doing things the first time, then you can build it. And then you can get to a mature situation where the institution isn't being challenged, its decisions are. Then people are playing the game, they're not fighting the game. So if you're an aid agency, this is what you need to do to support us. At the beginning, when the challenges are to build networks and get things done, find someone who can do it. Find an individual or a small group of people that you can find, that you can either, it's not impossible from within, but it's more likely to come from without. Find them, give them the power, and stick with them and support them. Then evolve into coaching a local team to build capacity. Because that's what you need. The end state is a local team, a local leadership, but you need to coach them through the first process of getting there. And if you've got a local team that is involved in the process of fighting off and winning some of these battles, they're personally invested in the institution and they'll become the leaders of the future. Then once you have a mature institution that can, where the structures and the frameworks are what guarantees the independence of the institution, then you can have local leadership. And then external expertise is more project-based and more, we have this particular issue that we need to solve. Now, my interesting reflection is, you know, how my, as I'm aid-funded through projects, I am much, all the terminology of my contract is like I'm an expert, and I have short-term aims and short-term goals and deliverables that I have to deliver. But that's not what I'm actually doing. That list was drawn up 2 years ago. It's no longer relevant. I'm more of a coach, a bit of a doer. So in summary, small doesn't mean simple, but it does mean close, and be ready for that. And be ready to navigate the J-curve. Expect it to happen, because it will happen. And finally, make sure that if you are going to support an agency like an independent agency that's got to play in the role in the market, design the support for the needs of the situation, not based on what the aid guidebook says. So where next for us? 2012, we're at the bottom of the J-curve. My view is when we're emerging from this infancy stage and we're getting into building a capacity of the team. And interesting, the next couple of years are going to be interesting because we haven't tested these relationships recently. So we've got some interesting challenges on the way. The biggest thing for us now is establishing financial independence because we don't have any revenue of our own. So that's our big thing that we need to get done in the next 12 months. So it's a bit of a rollercoaster ride through my life as a regulator in Vanuatu in the Pacific context. I hope that was interesting. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Oh, thank you very much, James, for fitting such a lot in to such a short presentation. I think that was fascinating. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. We're now going to go from the Pacific to Asia, from the small to the big, and I'd like to ask you to welcome Shika Jha, who'll be talking on the Asian energy subsidies and reform in Asia.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. James talked about Vanuatu being the second highest electricity prices. He's having the second highest electricity prices in the world. Do you know which country has the first highest? It's the Philippines, where I live. And people, the really high-up people who are the haves, who really matter in the country, they pay as much as something like $800 a month on the air conditioning of the houses. So you can imagine where the money is coming from and where it's going. And in fact, that tells us also that pricing is an integral part of infrastructure development, like Stephen was saying in the morning. So my talk is about pricing in terms of how to eliminate subsidies or reduce subsidies so that you have the right prices in the market. And this is a project that we are currently conducting. It's coming to an end very soon. And I'm going to present some preliminary results. In this, we are being supported by IISD, which is the International Institute for Sustainable Development in Canada, and they have a arm called GSI, the Global Subsidies Initiative in Geneva. And Tara Lan from Geneva is here to answer all the difficult questions for you. Okay, so I'll briefly tell you about why we wanted to do this study, what we have actually done in the study, and tell you some preliminary results, and what are the findings that would be applicable to not just the countries we are studying, but also to the other countries. So by way of background, you know that fossil fuel subsidies, which are on coal, oil, and gas, they are widespread all over the world, in particular in Asia as well. And they are major components of electricity production in most countries. So we are looking basically at the fossil fuel subsidies. And as you know, because of the subsidy, the government are not able to spend that much amount of resources on other kinds of development needs. For example, if you just consider the example of Indonesia, it spends about 4.5% of GDP on just the fossil fuel subsidies alone. And if you compare that with the infrastructure spending by the government, it's about 2.5%. And if you look at the education and health together, that's only about 1.5% of GDP. So that tells you the magnitudes of how much money goes into this. Secondly, these subsidies are an inefficient means of helping the poor. Because if you subsidize the prices, that means you are making it available to the entire population, so everybody benefits, whether they are rich or the poor. And normally the energy commodities are consumed by the rich people. They have the cars, they have the air conditioning and so on. So they are the ones who get most of the subsidies. So this is not the right means of subsidizing the poor, really. What you should be doing is actually targeting the subsidies to the poor rather than subsidizing the prices in the market. And they are also a major cause of greenhouse gas emissions. They release so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that is becoming a very difficult issue to control. And as Stephen was mentioning earlier, the G20 group of countries and as well as the APEC group of countries, they have all agreed to phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, as they call it. But if you go and look at the fine print, none of the countries, I think, has specified exactly what they're going to do. If at all they have specified something, it's a very, very minor component of the subsidies that they have picked out. And they say, okay, we'll try to phase it out by 2020. So there are difficulties. As I was saying, there are difficulties from the vested interests. In the previous talk by James, you have heard about what all difficult stakeholders you have to deal with. So, for example, if the rich people are getting the benefits, they would be having a vested interest to block the subsidy reform. And similarly, there are concerns that the governments have genuine concerns over the impacts any subsidy removal or reform would have, because the prices are going to rise in the market and it's going to immediately impact the poor people. So they have to worry about how to then protect the poor. So country circumstances also will determine what kind of impacts subsidy removal will have. And it's not only that, the subsidies have actually been rising. Again, taking the example of Indonesia, in 2009, soon after the global financial crisis, when the oil prices shot up to, say, $100 a barrel and above, at that time they were subsidizing to the extent of about 100 billion peso, rupiah, peso is in the Philippines, about 100 billion rupiah worth of fossil fuel subsidies they were giving. By 2012, in 3 years' time, it had multiplied to $350 billion, 50 billion rupiah. So in this project, we are looking at three countries in Asia. One is from South Asia, which is India, and the other two from Southeast Asia. And they represent a very large range of circumstances. If I just try to round off, for example, their per capita incomes in the GDP, in the PPP current prices, then India has about $4,000, US dollars. Indonesia has about $5,000. And Thailand has about $10,000. And they have different kinds of pricing. They have different kinds of subsidies and so on. So they give a mix of different circumstances. Now, in this study, we try to do three things. First is we try to estimate what are the levels of subsidies for the consumers of energy and for the producers of energy. Secondly, we try to estimate what would be the impact of phasing out subsidies, either in one go or slowly over time, gradually, on the households, poor and the rich, on the energy system itself, like how it would impact the composition of energy use, and finally on the macroeconomic indicators like GDP, unemployment, inflation, and so on, and also on the environmental impacts. Finally, this is the last phase that we are still working on, is how to design effective safety net mechanisms that can protect the poor when you phase out the subsidies. So as I said earlier, we are looking at oil, coal, and gas as a fossil fuels, and electricity as well, because a large majority of electricity is produced using these fuels. In Indonesia, for example, these three fossil fuels account for about 70% of total electricity production. In Indonesia, it's about 86%. So India is 70%, Indonesia is 86%, and in Thailand, it's as high as 93%. So if you reform the fossil fuel subsidies, you are automatically going to affect the prices of electricity that can be charged. And the second part is the producer subsidies. Most of the studies that you see which have estimated subsidies, they only look at consumer subsidies, because it's very, very difficult to find out how much subsidies go into the production of energy resources, because most of the time they are owned by public sector enterprises. In these three countries, for example, we have selected the three individual items because we can't find data. We are looking at coal in India and electricity in Indonesia and natural gas for vehicles in Thailand. Now, coal in India is the largest component of energy, of electricity input, and electricity in Indonesia has a problem that about 30% of the people are not covered. They don't have access. Plus the geography of several islands, which does not allow you to have grids of electricity passing through different parts of the country. That's a problem. And in Thailand, the government has been promoting natural gas for vehicles as an alternative kind of fuel. And in all of these three areas, the public sector enterprises have a big say in what's produced, how it's produced. And it's very difficult to find out what kind of subsidies are prevailing within the enterprises. It's very difficult to get data because they are not published. So you might ask, why do we want to estimate the subsidies again when we have international agencies like the IEA, the International Energy Agency, and so on, which are doing this already? What we are doing is we are looking at it as a bottom-up approach, whereas what they do is as a top-down approach. So they look at what's called the price gap, looking at the difference between the reference price, which may be an average of international prices and domestic prices, depending upon how much of your production is coming from the, how much of your supply is coming from the two sources, and looking at the retail prices. So what happens is when you look at the reference prices, they are kind of average of, say, for electricity, it will be an average of generation, transmission, and distribution prices, which may not capture the actual subsidy or the tariff structure in each of the countries. It may not capture what is the endpoint price that's being charged at different endpoints. So we try to look at all of those individual items. And I won't go into this to save time, because what we are doing here, I'm just telling you very briefly, we are looking at what are the actual costs that the governments incur. It's not a notional cost which is presented by some of the other agencies, but what we are looking at the actual financial costs that are incurred by the government in terms of direct payments or in terms of, for example, foregone revenues by giving tax exemptions and so on. And I would like to say that the subsidy estimates that we have are higher than what the governments have produced, and they could be even higher if we had data on all the different subsidies that we want to estimate. So this is just a summary of the results that we have for the three countries. So this is for the latest year for which we have the data available. And you can see that the producer subsidies are very small because we don't have much data. We are looking at only one type of producer subsidy. But on the whole, it amounts to about 2.5% of GDP for India, about 4% for Indonesia, and about 2% for Thailand. And if you compare in terms of the billions of dollars, just the second last row, the estimates we have are about $49 billion for India. For IEA, it is $43 billion for the same year. And for Indonesia, ours is 36 versus 27 from IEA. And for Thailand, we have $9 billion, but we are still not sure about the numbers because we are not able to get the data and so on because of political problems going on right now. So we might have to revise those numbers, study the preliminary numbers. Now for India, these are top five subsidies, which account for about 93% of total subsidies that are given from our estimates. And these are basically in the form of direct public spending for reducing the market prices, giving a price subsidy at the margin, and also losses by the oil companies that are incurred by the companies themselves. So you'll see that there are differences between the types of subsidies which are given. So for India, these are two types basically. For Indonesia, the five top largest subsidies are basically in the form of budgetary outlays on price subsidy, basically of one type, and they account for about 93% of total subsidies. For Thailand, these top five subsidies account for about 96% of all subsidies we have estimated, and they are mainly in the form of tax exemptions and also the government's budgetary support to different oil companies and so on. Now, I won't bore you with the details of this modeling exercise. I'll just tell you briefly what they intend to do. We have three kinds of models. In the first one, we try to look at the short-term impacts, the immediate impacts. That's what worries the governments most of the times, that immediately if you remove the subsidies, what will happen in the market? So this is using the SAM or the social accounting matrix. The second set of modeling exercise looks at what will happen in the energy allocation. Suppose we have got the first round impacts and we know how much are the impacts on prices, GDP and so on. If you feed that into the different industry structures, we will find out how they try to change their composition of energy use. And the third part actually looks at the longer term impacts up to going up to 2030, where we look at what happens over time, not just the immediate short-term impact, but in the long term. So there are these different scenarios. I will not go into all of them when I present the results, but what we do is, the first is the current case, the existing case, which is the business as usual. Second, we look at what happens when you overnight eliminate all the subsidies, like what happened in Nigeria, for example, if you are aware of that in 2012. Overnight, they increased the subsidy, the prices, they doubled the prices because all the subsidies were removed. They had riots and so on, and they were forced to cut down the prices again and bring back 30% of the subsidies. But learning from their experience, Ghana went ahead and they did gradually, slowly increase the prices, and they had no problems at all. So we are looking at a full reduction in one go, and we are looking at 20% reduction of subsidies over 5-year period, and how that impacts different variables. Now within this, we are looking at three different cases. For the savings that you get from elimination of subsidies, the energy subsidies that you give out, where do we put that money? In the first one, we assume that there is no reallocation. It just goes back to the government budget to repay the debt, for example, or to reduce the budget deficit. In the second case, we assume that all of these savings are given away to compensate all the households completely, and whatever remains goes back to the budget so that the government spends it back again in the economy to revive the economy. In the third one, we assume that only the 40% bottom population is compensated fully, and the rest of it is spent by the government. By no means the first scenario is meant to be a realistic scenario, as I told you about Nigeria's case. It's just to get an idea of how much could be the highest impact that you could get from this. So this is the short-term impacts. As you can see, the first set of rows is the immediate elimination of subsidies, where you can see that if the subsidies are not reallocated to any of the households, if it is just put back to repay the debt, for example, there will be a reduction of GDP compared to the business as usual case, BAU, which will vary from -2% to -13%. 2 is in Indonesia, 13 is in Thailand. Now, this 13% we have to still check because we are not sure about this number. It looks a bit too large. And the second one is if you compensate the 40% of the bottom population, the poorest population, then you see that GDP actually rises. There's a little gain in GDP rather than a loss in GDP. This is also because when you pay back to the household, they create demand in the economy, and when the government spends the money on the budget, that also revives the demand. The second set of rows, if you see, this is the 20% reform, which we call, which is a 20% reduction over five-year period, every year 20% reduction. In this, again, you see that the magnitudes of the changes are much smaller because it is happening over time. And again, in the first case, there is a negative effect on GDP when there is no reallocation, but when you support the poor people, it increases the GDP. Now, this is about what happens to the energy use itself. And we see that in India, the main energy items that are impacted are coal and oil. And in Indonesia, it's coal and natural gas and also petroleum. But in this case, when the consumption goes down by -2% to -4%, people are able to switch over to biomass. In the case of Thailand, they're able to switch over to biomass and electricity both. So it depends upon what kind of alternative substitutes you have in the economy that people can move over to. Okay, this the second part of the analysis looks at how the energy use changes. And we see that in all countries, the affected sectors are agriculture, industry, and the residential sector, because they are the major users of energy. And transport is also affected in Thailand because of their NGV policy, the natural gas for the vehicles. Now, in the final analysis, I won't go into the details. I already talked about what is done in this model. I'll just present two graphics. The first graph gives you the changes in the GDP. The second graph gives you the changes in the consumer price inflation. So if you look at the curve at the bottom, the pink colored curve on the left side, it tells you when the savings from the energy subsidy are not reallocated to the people, the GDP goes down continuously after the first 5-year period. And it goes below the initial starting point. Okay, anyway. And the second one, the yellow line on top, shows that if you support all the population by completely compensating them for the rise in prices, then the GDP goes down still, but the reduction is not so bad. So this is a way to convince the people, to convince the government that the effect will not be so bad. And similarly, the price inflation, if you see on the right-hand side, in the case of no reallocation, the prices rise much more than in the case of reallocation to the household. Now, these are some preliminary results which I already was talking about. What happens in the long run is that the impact of reform dissipate over time, and the positive impacts become larger and larger, and the negative impacts become smaller and smaller. And this is something that needs to be conveyed to the governments to create some kind of, make it more palatable for them to agree to reforms. And as we expected, GDP changes become much smaller over time. The fossil fuel emissions decline, and the energy intensive industries and other sectors which are negatively impacted, they start performing a little better over time. So, what lessons can we learn from this? This is my last slide. First of all, that if you reallocate the subsidy savings to the poor, that's a good policy to do, because you are increasing the prices, but on the other hand, you are making sure that the poor are not really affected. Secondly, if you use the public resources, which are really scarce in many countries, if you use them more efficiently, you will get more progressive kind of social indicators, social outcomes. But the problem is not so much about deciding what to do, but actually implementing it on the ground. So we talked about compensating the bottom 40% people. It's easy to model it, but may not be so easy to actually implement in practice, because even if you have targeted transfers, there are so many issues. You have leakages, you have fraud, you have diversions and all that, so you have to deal with all that. And you have to also examine what are the kinds of safety net policies and how to design them to protect the poor. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Shika. Some of those numbers you presented on total subsidies are very sobering. And I guess it's disappointing in a way not more has been done, but it shows it's a very pressing, it remains a very pressing issue. We'll now go on to our third speaker. So I'd like to invite Sanjeevi to come and give his presentation on road infrastructure maintenance. And he'll be looking, drawing on both African and Pacific experience. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning. Stephen, how do I change slides?
This is forward, back.
Okay, thank you. Stephen has already given me a pep talk on the time I'm allowed for this presentation, so I'll be going fairly quickly through the slides, and I'll be happy to answer questions later. Well, I'm going to give a little talk on what we did in Africa in terms of road maintenance and the institutional reforms and how that may apply in some part, at least, to the Pacific. If you look at Africa roads, the road density is about 10 kilometers per 100 square kilometers. That compares with, actually, Australia is around 11 kilometers per 100 square kilometers. It's about 70 in the US, 500 in Singapore. So obviously, you know, there are big differences. 25% of the roads are paved. In Australia, they're around 50%, near 100% in the US. And asset management is really challenging. For every 1 million of GDP, there are 6.6 kilometers of roads that have to be maintained. That compares with about half a kilometer in the US and about 3.5 kilometers around the world. And the country situations, of course, vary widely, as you know. There are four regional corridors in the north, south, west, and east, which are very important. They are less than 10,000 kilometers in total, but they have $200 billion in trade annually. On the other hand, you have millions of kilometers of secondary roads and rural roads, which carry less than 10% of the traffic in Africa. But they're very important. They're the key to rural communities and agricultural productivity, so they can't be ignored. If you look at road comparisons to other regions, and you look at the median, because that's probably the easiest to look at, Africa has 64% of roads in good and fair condition. That's the lowest among the main regions. Latin America has 77%, Asia has 88%, and Europe is close to 100%. Of course, these regional comparisons are fraught with difficulties and in terms of definitions and timing and so on, so they're very rough indicators of what you can look at. We did a study a few years ago about of all infrastructure, and transport means in sub-Saharan Africa are something like $19 billion a year. But actually most of that, or more than 50% of that, is maintenance. And this was something that was actually very important for us to realize, because there was with the World Bank and the other big donors like the European Union and the African Development Bank, there's always been this tendency to build the network without worrying too much about maintenance. So this was an eye opener when we did this. And in terms of reforms, institutional reforms, there has been an evolution in Africa. Before the pre-80s, there was this greater recognition that poor maintenance was actually quite costly, and road deterioration models were created. In the mid-80s, there was a user-pay model that started gaining credence, and road sector reforms. And what really helped a lot was that there was a lot of knowledge sharing among the African countries themselves, a little bit like what was said about what is needed in the Pacific Islands as well. There was a lot of comparing of notes, experience, peer learning, and so on, which was very helpful. In the 1990s, there were more and more independent road agencies, and there was the introduction of second-generation road funds, which I'll talk a little bit about. And as we go into the 20th century, there is increased acceptance of the importance of commercialization of road management. So road funds. The second-generation road funds, as the so-called second-generation road funds, have certain characteristics, really to make them independent and to give them a transparent and clear operating guidelines. So they have a clear legal basis. They separate the financing function from the technical function. Road charges are established. The revenue is transferred directly. It doesn't go through the tax system. It comes directly from wherever the road users are, like a fuel levy or something like that, straight to the road fund. There's user representation, truckers, private sector is on the board of the road fund. There are clear revenue allocation rules, and of course there is independent auditing and public reporting for transparency. The road funds, as you can see, have done quite well. If you, especially with regard to independent auditing, road user charges and revenue allocation, most of them have taken them on board. The rest are, you know, they're getting better, but there's still room for improvement. And if you, one takes a kind of creates a score looking at how many of the conditions have been met, there are, it's not too bad. But also one has to remember that this is not the only thing. For instance, South Africa, as you can see, is fairly low on this, but it's got good roads. But very few of its roads depend on the road fund for maintenance. So it also depends on what is the proportion of roads and what is the relative importance of the road fund in the economy and in maintenance as well. But in some other countries, it's very, very important. With regard to road agencies, what these independent agencies seem to try to do is to separate the strategic design of infrastructure from the implementation. And the agencies do the implementation. And ideally, it should be run by a competent chief executive officer and a board which includes private sector. But in practice, what has happened is that often there are political considerations that take place in the creation of boards, and therefore the it's not always the best leadership, and the constitutional boards have also not been the best. But nonetheless, what we have found is that agencies, independent agencies, especially with funding, is quite useful. This is actually a cluster analysis of the percentage of main roads in good or fair condition in different clusters of countries, whether middle income, low income, or geography, coastal island, landlocked, and the kind of institutions and the financing with the, if there's a fuel levy, the kind of financing. And I don't want to go into all the details, but as you can see, when you have a road fund and a road agency together, it's actually quite helpful. When they are only one of them, it's not as good as when they're both there. But if you look at that same chart for rural network, the experience is not as marked. And there are reasons for that, which I'll come to in a bit. But as you can see, it still is an advantage, but not as much. So to sum up, a road fund by itself is only marginally better than a road agency, but both together make a significant difference for main roads. And road quality, the quality of the road fund has also got has a significant correlation with good roads. But countries with higher fuel levies do marginally better, but not that much. And when you go to rural roads, as I said, the correlation is not that strong, and there are reasons for that. There's resource allocation is often driven by local and considerations and priorities. Technical capacity is less available, and measurements also are less accurate. It's hard to survey hundreds of thousands of kilometers of rural roads as it is to survey main roads. So what are the challenges in the Pacific Islands? This is well known. I mean, the ADB said in 2007, poor maintenance limits the capacity of the region's assets to prove sustained services. The World Bank said in Pacific, governments have often focused on building new infrastructure rather than investing in sustainable infrastructure. And even back in 1991, the IMF said O&M expenditures have a low priority in investments, in budgets. And the reasons for poor maintenance are many. I'm not going to go through this slide in detail, but the incentives are sometimes lacking. They're wrong. Their organizational capacity is weak, and there are also resource constraints. They all lead to infrastructure maintenance. But what is common? I mean, the Pacific Island countries are much smaller networks, but they do need a few things. They need user input in planning. They need dependable financing. Maintenance requirements must be visible in planning and donor coordination, that is in strategies and national plans. A pragmatic approach to include the private sector, commercialization, maintenance contracts, and so on. And a targeted approach for outer islands and remote communities, which need a different technology, maybe labor-based approaches. And of course, climate change adaptation is very important. But again, it has to be done with reason. Do you Do you plan for a 20-year event or a 5-year event, given the resource constraints? And these are issues that every country needs to look at very carefully in the Pacific Islands. So a couple of case studies on how reform has worked in the Pacific. In Samoa, there was strong political leadership and will and a consultative approach to reform the roads maintenance. So in 2002, the Public Works Department was spun off its technical activities into three firms. Staff were either retrenched or given compensation or given opportunities to join the firms, and a very few were kept retained in the Public Works Department. And the firms themselves were assured contracts for 3 years, so they had a basis as a springboard to develop themselves and become viable entities. A year later, they created an asset management system that looked after, that kept track of all the roads and the maintenance needs, the rehabilitation and so on, how old they were, condition. And the new Public Works Department was subsumed into a Ministry of Infrastructure. And finally, in 2009, they have created an autonomous land transport authority, which has taken over this asset management system and is managing all the contracts. Funding for roads has also some reform in here. The Solomon Islands National Transport Fund has focused on donor and funding priorities much more carefully on maintenance, and the maintenance funding has increased. Partner funding is also being channeled entirely through the National Transport Fund, which also helps with regard to coordination of partner funding for the infrastructure. And the results so far are promising, but needs to be evaluated in a few years to see what the lessons are and how things can be improved. PNG also has a National Road Fund, and it also has a road authority, and with independent oversight. The road fund has been able to ensure that maintenance funds are not diverted, and it has also created a lot of innovations like long-term management contracts. But on the other hand, the funding has not been adequate. So there is a fund and there is an authority, but there isn't enough money in there to do all the maintenance that's needed. And more recently, the Tonga Road Fund has been established, and we'll have to see how that works. So this is a very quick example that is in a publication which is done by PREF on the cost of maintenance if you don't maintain, and the cost of maintenance if you do, which is obviously quite stark. Now, another issue that is important for especially the more remote islands is the labor-based approaches to infrastructure maintenance. There are some definitions which have been used by the ILO, and there is employment intensive, which is really optimizes labor but gives it a priority and not many hand tools. And in those cases, the project labor content is around 40% to 80%. Then there's labor intensive, which is maximizes labor, and it's really about employment, only hand tools, and the labor content is about 80%. And then there's labor-based equipments, or LBES approaches, which are about 40% labor content. And those have small-scale equipment and labor. And of course, equipment-based typically use about 5 to 15% of labor. So there's a big difference between, in terms of employment and using local labor, between employment-based and the labor-based approaches. So what are the pros and cons of labor-based maintenance? Economic, obviously it's lower cost. Income generation and employment for unskilled local labor. Capacity building, you make people more employable, and you can also encourage private sector development because of entrepreneurship. But on the other hand, low wages means it could also be misused, predatory practices. Sometimes there's only short-term employment with little impact on structural issues, so the employment really doesn't catch on. And of course, for the private sector development to really be sustainable, it has to be formalized. Social, there's empowerment. Local communities are empowered, and entrepreneurship is encouraged. Workers can stay in their communities. The disadvantage, of course, is that it's a slow-moving process, and unless employment is sustained, workers can also feel that they're abandoned once the project is over, so it has to be thought through. In terms of technical considerations, obviously it's best when it's remote, when there is topography doesn't allow big heavy machines, and when it's hard to get stuff there. But from a standpoint of engineering, if there's a lot of earthworks or if there is no availability of local materials, then labor-based methods become harder. And also you need a longer work period, and the quality sometimes can be poorer. Institutionally, obviously, labor-based approaches are easy. You know, sometimes you drive along roads in Africa and people have self-volunteered to do the maintenance, and then they just ask for donations from people. I mean, that's the lowest case, but so it's easy to put together approaches. And capacity is built, obviously. But on the other hand, administration of lots of small contracts can be harder and more complicated. And so detailed supervision is needed. So we have some lessons from labor-based methods, approaches in from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. First thing is the program objectives have to be absolutely clear. Is it employment? What is the level of maintenance? What are the kinds of projects that you're going to take? What is the balance between labor-based approaches and more equipment-intensive approaches? Technical appraisals have to be thorough. Participation of beneficiary communities and local government in program is absolutely essential. And the approach must be defined. Is it the use of a force account? Are we trying to create micro-enterprises that will do the work under or establish contractors, community organizations? Needs to be done. And finally, there will be productivity and labor costs, which have to be addressed upfront rather than postponed and then have issues surfacing later. So we have two examples in the Pacific Islands, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. In the Solomon Islands, it was it was successful. It included women. There were clearly transparent approaches to do that. And so it was inclusive. It used almost 100% of the national communities were all employed in this in some way or the other using private contractors. And there was a kind of a political and a kind of a national impetus for that, and that was it was post-conflict. And there was also high youth unemployment, so it addressed those two issues. So there was a kind of a strategy behind it. And it has been successful in that the labor-based approaches have moved into other services, such as garbage collection and municipal services and so on. And they've also, the participants have been entrepreneurial. They've created little canteens to sell small goods and so on, and made this thing a value-creating proposition. In Vanuatu, on the other hand, it didn't work, and the reason was that it was kind of imposed without really thinking about how it would succeed. The roads, many of the roads were beyond normal maintenance, so obviously labor-based approaches couldn't work. The philosophy was not well thought out and communicated to the communities concerned, and so it was a bit ad hoc in different parts, and very little success was got out of it, and later it was abandoned. So some closing thoughts before I end, and that is that Pacific Island countries' focus on maintenance has been late, but the picture is definitely changing, and people are getting more and more worried and earnest about it. But clearly more clarity in budget and expenditure framework on the cost of maintenance is needed. And even in my group where we do these national infrastructure plans, I think we need to focus a lot more, not only on new investment and what the government would like to do, but also on what the envelope will be if it takes into account all the maintenance that needs to be done. I think that there was an estimate made by Matt that I think about 4% of GDP is kind of a rough estimate of what is needed for infrastructure maintenance, and that comes to about $1.2 billion a year. In the Pacific Islands, I think out of that about 700 to 800 million is just Fiji and PNG, I think. So, and then of course the donor agreements have to be clear, and this is for the G20, so that you keep the focus on maintenance as you go forward in these countries. We have done two publications recently in PRIF. One was published last year, and in fact ANU was involved, and the author Matt is sitting over there. It was a build, challenge the build, neglect, rebuild paradigm. And another one that's coming out in the near future is a review of labor-based approaches to infrastructure maintenance, which we should be publishing in April. Thank you very much. And that was good to be here.
Great. Thanks very much, Sanjeev. I think it's fascinating to see. We don't hear much about Africa, even less than about the Pacific. So that was a really useful contribution. So could I ask all three speakers to come up and sit on the front table? And can I ask you all, we have pretty successfully preserved a substantial amount of time for questions. So I hope you're going to take advantage of that by contributing to the discussion yourself and asking our panellists some questions. We have got some people with roving mics, and I see we've got a couple of questions down the front, so we might start in the front with Zhongxiang and then Quentin. Perhaps we'll take these two questions and then go to the panel.
I'm not in charge of three questions, but my comment is this with my India colleagues and about subsidies. And, you know, because it's 220 the call for the remote subsidies, and then I may take on this request, and last September released the, you know, exhibition of subsidies for about 175 countries. And this really I understand is you, some projects similar to yours, for example, SPs, you know, produce subsidies on product side, subsidies on the consumer side, and end up is more or less like the so-called pre-tax subsidies. But I am able to go more than also look at the post-tax subsidies, which basically includes that some tax supposed to collect, you didn't, or maybe tax treat the energy sector more fairly than others. Another one is eternity cost. So the end up, if you take this all into consideration, this is every country are subsidized, and then US is the last one, about $520 billion, China is second, about $280, Russia is third. And there's another conclusion from that study is this is the post-tax is more or less about four times than pre-tax subsidies. So I see your study more or less like, if you based on your definition, your result, more or less like similar to their pre-tax subsidies. And you will end up like 4.8% of GDP for some countries. If we're along the IMF line, if post-tax will be four times, then you end up like four multiplied by 5 is 20% GDP. So that will be considered to be very difficult. So my general comment is, you know, because we do the energy, we also recommend the government that we should reform into subsidies. Sometimes this kind of stuff is very good. Given you pick up the more specific three countries, I'd like to see much more in detail, and you can maybe give some comments about this general calculation from IMF, so that we help people to have some more good understanding about this kind of issue. Otherwise, all these multinational countries always give us so big, but the national government sometimes say it's very small, it's only 4%, because they always use the can.
Okay, great question. We'll just take Quentin.
Thank you, and thanks to all the three speakers in the session. Very much enjoyed it. But I wanted to connect with what Daniel was talking about this morning on infrastructure to this session here and subsidies. And I just want to pose a question to all three of you, perhaps Daniel as well. This issue about infrastructure in itself, I mean, obviously you understand that infrastructure generates benefits, but what about sort of turning it back to the basics and thinking, well, what's the issue here? It's about generating, presumably, consumer benefits and consumer surplus, producer surplus, thinking about it in the context of dynamic efficiency, because clearly we've got a problem here when, you know, two of our G20 cousins, India and Indonesia are spending $85 billion on subsidies, energy subsidies, yet they're not delivering in the context of infrastructure. I can think of other G20 countries as well that haven't been mentioned. And how do we connect that to actually delivering better outcomes for consumers? And how do we connect that to producers actually having the incentive to make those investments? I mean, India is a classic case where there's been inadequate investment because there have been inadequate incentives. And I know James is talking about it in a micro sense. It's not just the big country issue, it's also on a small scale. So in other words, the question really is, how do we get that connection about producers, consumers, dynamic efficiency in the context of infrastructure and G20?
Okay. Well, I might invite Shika to respond first, and then the other two. And yeah, Daniel, you're very welcome to add in.
Very nice questions. I was expecting some of these, actually. What we are actually worried about not so much is the extent of subsidy itself, although I did point that out, and you talked about the IMF study last year, they have what they say is that in addition to the subsidies that are being given right away, they are lost taxes, the government has lost, and they what they have done is they have looked at the optimal taxes. So, first of all, as I was saying, that we are looking at the actual financial liabilities on the government, not on the notional liabilities. But if you look at the IMF, of course, it's still continuing with the same notional kind of identification of subsidies. Because it's optimal taxes are some kind of notional taxes, right? They are not really in practice. They would be the ideal ones if you can really implement them. You can find out how much the optimal taxes are and implement them. So what that would do is actually multiply the size of the subsidy itself overall. Three tax and those type of things. That's a different matter. My focus is more on what happens when you eliminate subsidies in an integrated fashion for the economy. So if you, instead of having, say, 5%, if you have 20%, the impact would get multiplied four times, finally. So if you look at the qualitative kind of inferences we draw, then you can always change the quantitative value. And for your question, I think that's also a very good question about when you have the savings from elimination of subsidies, why don't you put that money into infrastructure development itself? So that's an alternative. There are always different uses of the money that you can make. We are looking at putting it back for the households, but we have considered various different types of things. That I have to say, why don't you put it into climate change initiatives, why don't you put it back into energy efficiency initiatives, why don't you put it back into infrastructure. But they all have different impacts. And we have to see what are the best uses of the scarce open resources. So you can have a combination of these different types of alternatives. It depends upon your country context.
Yeah, just have to pitch in on that, so question from Clinton as well. I guess if you look at the overall role, and looking at from my perspective, I asked context, what is the role of subsidy in the, for example, an energy marketplace? If you assume that it's good for consumers to have access to reliable and affordable energy, but the reality of the economy is that that's not possible to do because if it was reliable, it would not be affordable without some degree of external funding from somewhere. Then I guess the question is how can, if there's going to be external funding from somewhere, be it a subsidy or aid for infrastructure development or something, and the interesting question is what's the best way of using external funds to deliver a long-term result? And historically, obviously, we have energy subsidies in Vanuatu indirectly. There's an excise exemption on imported fuel. And there have been some projects that have delivered some infrastructure in the energy infrastructure. So we have subsidies coming from all directions. And one of the issues that I have to deal with is how that distorts the natural functioning of the market, so you get the inefficient results. But like you say, if something's put away, that's a far worse outcome than some kind of gradual reallocation of that subsidy from the situation today to something that will hopefully be more sustainable in the long term. I mean, it goes back in my context in Vanuatu, the interesting question would be, given the technology available today, are we ever going to? There's no technology available today that will deliver reliable and affordable energy for everyone in Vanuatu. So right now we need some kind of external support in some form. If that changes in the future, we want to create the mechanism so that the market can adjust so that it's what indeed eventually expected.
So did you want to comment from the roads perspective?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with subsidies, which the road did not subsidize. We need about 10,000 vehicles per day. There's no country in the Pacific Islands that have that kind of traffic. So the roads are going to be built. But then the point is that because of the roads, you get economic growth and you get other factors that come into play, you can't get road. But they can't look at it just on the profitability of that road itself. So subsidies are basically helping the economy in different ways, and they have to be used wisely. But the broad question that you're asking is, without the subsidies, you know, why aren't things better? And there, I think the issue is, how good are the institutions who are accountable for using this money? Are they transparent? Are they inside the points that are brought up
introduction from the agencies, the roads, also what you said, the impact, the new TVs. You need to have strong institutions, and certainly institutions that are somewhat independent from the political layer. So that's always where, especially in Africa, we have a lot of difficulties. And the politicians get involved, it gets more complicated. So building strong institutions with independent representation and wide representation and having accountability and processes and transparency, that is the way to make sure that the ones that the regulators and the authorities are doing a good job and there's a public scrutiny of what's happening.
I just make a very general comment, really endorses Sanjeevi's point there, that I think for the G20 work, it's looking at what are the incentives for government and the incentives for investors, and then looking at what impediments there may be. And then that sort of analysis we've just seen in all the presentations points to that sort of information. It's very useful for governments then to inform the decisions about prioritisation of projects, the planning projects, and then how they fund them. So we're not looking at a set prescription for investment in infrastructure, but rather probably drawing on those experiences to endorse, I don't like the phrase toolbox, it's probably used, but a series of underlying principles that might guide governments in developing better means to track benefits. It's a huge amount of money we're talking about, and a lot of governments are talking about economies. It can't be funded purely through the public purpose, so it's got to be attractive to the private sector, but it may not be a pure user pay model.
Okay, great. We've got a question at the back. Yep. Questions here and here. Yeah, Frank, please.
Frank Yotsi from the Crawford School. Just wondering if Harry can draw out the panelists on the question of political economy of these difficult economic reforms in infrastructure and energy and in subsidies. Is there something positive that we've learned or something negative about the political process of actually getting these difficult reforms implemented? And Dr. Jali, you know, on the basis of the statistics you present is, of course, quite a difficult picture emerging with the extent of energy subsidies still prevalent. On the other hand, we've had what I guess you could call a tremendous success story on subsidy removal or subsidy reduction just recently in Indonesia, where an issue that has been politically very, very difficult in the past has apparently been addressed quite successfully. With substantial reductions in petrol and diesel subsidies. This is something that can be learned and applied elsewhere.
Okay, we'll just hold that question right at the back.
My name is Hua from Crawford School. I have two questions to the presentation of Dr. Chan. The first one is I would love to hear more about who benefit about the subsidies. Like which household is the rich or the poor, or industry would be benefit more from the subsidies or household. The second one is I find the findings a little bit hard to really follow because when you say that if the allocation of the savings to the 40 poorest households would increase the GDP, I mean, there's a big gap between the two scenarios that I find is a little bit hard to understand because I think that the demand for the poorest 40% household would be quite small. Thanks.
Okay, I know there are lots of questions, so just bear with me. We'll take one more on this, since you're on this side, and then we'll go back to the panel. We'll try and get you in for the final round. Yeah, please.
Thank you. Thanks, Australian Public Service. I wanted to draw a little bit more on the experience of the panel because one thing I really enjoyed about each of your presentations is practical, evidence-based potential for policy creation. As you would all know, infrastructure, development and investment is a very crowded space on the international agenda. I'm working on APEC issues, so Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, and we've been doing work in infrastructure development and financing and investment for the last decade. But Indonesia last year produced what I thought was a very good outcome, with strong contribution from the Treasury Department in establishing an experts advisory panel on which the FBI and the World Bank are both sitting, as well as many interested economies. And there's an overlap of 9 economies between the G20 proper, if you like, and APEC. Another outcome was the development of a national PPP centre in Indonesia. Which has obviously gone through iterations, but this is an attempt to try and co-locate PPP infrastructure expertise within a bureaucracy and then have an overarching expert advisory panel to help. I know the G20 and World Bank and others are also working on initiatives. The Philippines has a national PPP centre already. And I just wonder, with your collective expertise, where could governments, in your view, really prioritise to make pragmatic, practical, changing impact? So not just hold workshops or talk about training, but have a pragmatic impact. And where, in your view, could we be working more closely together to really create synergies for developmental impacts in some of the countries that we're talking about? Thank you.
Okay. Of course, we think workshops are very pragmatic, but apart from that, good question and some useful information. So I'll go back to the panel. Sheikha, do you want to start again?
Yeah. I think there was a question about Indonesia.
Yep.
On how to link it to social safety nets. You talked about the example of how successfully they have been able to reduce subsidies and also link to the benefits of the poor. In fact, Indonesia is one of the leading examples in the world for doing this. And the reason for their success is, in fact, partial, because last year in April they wanted to go ahead with further reforms, further reduction of subsidies. They were not able to, they had to roll back. But they had partial reforms. And the reason for that was they had a mechanism to protect the poor. So it's a kind of, safety net, which is like a food-based program or economic guarantee kind of scheme, which is linked only to the time when the subsidies are reduced. And they have done it twice in the past. I think about 2005 and another before. So every time there is this change coming in the energy prices, they announce beforehand, and they say that this is coming, and they put in place a mechanism to protect the poor before the subsidies are actually reformed. And that has been a successful example. And in fact, I think that also answers some of the questions coming from this side in the end. Yes, I think there's some related questions. There was another question about who benefits from these subsidies in the bank. And you said that what's the point of removing subsidies and giving back the savings to the bottom line of people who don't consume much energy. The question is, you don't look at the absolute amount of consumption, but you look at how much they are spending as part of their income. For the richer classes, it may be very small fraction. They may be spending 5% or 10% of income on energy. But if you look at the poor people, they may be spending like 50% or 40% of their income. So it's a huge impact on the community and the society. And that's why we're looking at the 40% of the
income. I understand the welfare impact for those households, but I just don't understand the impact on the GDP. I mean, if from the household, I agree, but from the GDP, because of you have to balance between increased demand for those households which consume a small fraction of the economy. On the other hand, demand has been suppressed because the price increased. That means the industry and the rich household who consume more have to suffer the high increase in the price. I mean that it is, I support the policy, I'm just saying that I don't see why it adds up to increase GDP.
Because you're not really suppressing the demand from the rest of the economy. The demand is coming from the government budget because you have a huge amount of savings. And as you say, only a small fraction of that goes to the poor people. The rest of it goes back into the government budget. And the government spends it back on it as it would do otherwise. That creates additional demand, which makes the GDP change positive.
Thank you.
There was a question about government priorities to create synergies. And as I was mentioning earlier, in the case of subsidy countries, we need to first set up a mechanism to protect the poor, advertise it immensely, make it very publicly known kind of a policy that's coming, create awareness, make people prepared for that, and then we can do something. So that's the kind of priority that I would talk about in terms of subsidies. But if there is a larger picture of infrastructure reform or involving the other stakeholders and so on in the overall scheme of things of reforming many different types of things, then it's a different matter.
So okay. James?
I think that there's an interesting common thread between those three questions, which is if the end goal that we're all kind of, that everybody, you know, the end good that we're trying to deliver is long-term sustainable infrastructure investment that delivers value to consumers, and subsidies or external funding is used in the most effective way, then I think that I suppose the key question would be, what can we do, what can we do to help ensure that outcome? And certainly my experience, the reason why the APCR work group exists is because in having a separate body, as in my case a utility regulator, or a road agency and road fund, separate funding where the revenues from that when designed to be spent on that use are transparently managed and used for that use, and decisions can be made on how cross-subsidy between different tariff structures, which is like to do with energy and water, how that will manage. One way that can be used to help navigate the political economy issues of establishing all of that is to separate it from the existing governmental political institutions and create an independent body, either a road agency, utility regulator, similar to a PIP, which is a similar energy, potentially an energy system. So that is one ingredient you can do. That certainly works if there are no, if the transparency mechanisms aren't working in the existing institutions as well, or there isn't capacity or there isn't funding, which is causing lots of.
Great. Yep, Sanjeev.
Again, I think that your question in any workshops I've told, like, what I think you need good, transparent regulatory framework to allow people to know what they can do and how much they can get. And on the basis of that, then you should target your subsidies to the people that need the subsidy. It shouldn't be broad-based subsidy, it should be quite important. And in this regard, an example is the output-based aid program. There is a global program for output-based aid, TPODEA, and in fact, in America, they have a program where they are, for certain households, they are connecting water. Water is not going to be subsidized, but they're making the connection to the households for free. And the company get paid based on the number of connections they make. And it has been huge success. So now the government wants to extend it from a Manila or a company to a national program to provide the aid actually to focus it on getting connections to households that otherwise couldn't afford to get a connection. But once they get the connection, the water they get from the pipe is about a fraction of what they pay to get water from a tap. It's like 1/10. So the only thing is that a little bit of extra money at the beginning to get the connection is there, and it's a much better system. So these kinds of very targeted forms of subsidies are essential. And if you're working to poverty alleviation, you have to have subsidies, and you've got to have them, you've got to use them in a way that makes the most amount of sense. The problem with subsidies is that they're broad-based, and everybody gets a subsidy, that's when it becomes a problem.
Okay, well, look, I know there are others who wanted to ask questions, but I'm afraid we are out of time here. It's time for lunch, so I apologise to those who didn't get a chance to ask a question. Please come and speak to the panellists. But let's now finish by thanking our three panellists for their excellent presentations.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.